afternoon. Welcome to this discussion on the regulation of hate speech in divided societies. My name is John Podesta, and I am the manager and editor of the Center for International Media Systems here at the National Endowment for Democracy. The center aims to highlight the indispensable role independent media play in democracies worldwide. In order to improve the effectiveness of international media systems programs, SEMA publishes recent reports, holds public discussions such as this one, and builds networks of media experts. Today's discussion will be moderated by David Lowe, Vice President for Government Relations and Public Affairs here at the National Endowment for Democracy. So with that, thank you, David, and I'll turn this over to you.
Great.
And to you.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Don. Good afternoon, everyone. Can everybody hear me all right? Should governments in divided societies regulate hate-filled propaganda that targets individuals on the basis of their race, ethnicity, religious beliefs, or any other group characteristic? That is the question before us this afternoon. But first, a word of background. The dilemmas governments face in approaching the problem of defamatory rhetoric is as old as the Republic. Plato's Republic, in fact. Plato recognized that those agitating against his ideal republic are capable of generating broad support by making false accusations to denigrate their enemies. And what has changed since Plato's time, certainly, are the number of platforms available to hate groups to spread their propaganda, from print to broadcast, now to the internet, and of course, text messaging. I did a quick search of the internet the other day and came up with the fact that virtually every established democracy, and a number of newer democracies as well, has some form of law outlawing hate speech. And even here in the United States, where speech is protected, of course, by the First Amendment, the courts have begun to uphold limitations to free speech where inflammatory rhetoric is designed to provoke physical violence. So the question is, are these statutes and rulings potential models for societies with strong ethnic and religious divisions? Of course, where to draw the line in a divided society between speech that is protected and speech that can be outlawed is never a simple matter. We know, for example, that statutes banning certain kinds of expression can easily be abused to silence or even punish the government's critics. And while incitement to genocide is a crime under international law, incitement to hatred is not. On the other hand, it should not be all that difficult, one would think, to distinguish between speech that is inflammatory and speech that merely offends. In considering the question of regulating hate speech with a stellar panel representing a cross-section of divided societies, we will try to answer several questions. One, is the potential misuse of laws against hate speech a greater threat to freedom of expression and democracy than hate speech itself? Two, are there alternative approaches other than the blunt instrument of the law that can mitigate the consequences of malicious propaganda aimed at particular groups of people? And three, and perhaps most critically, what can the international community do to deter and or lessen the impact of hate speech? I've been asked to make a couple of announcements before I introduce the panel. One is, of course, to silence your cell phones. We are recording this session, and keep in mind that those little things in front of you are microphones, and try to keep all papers away from that. So now let's turn to our panel. On my far right is Magai Akech, who is currently a Reagan Fussell Fellow here at the NED. He's an academic based in Nairobi, Kenya, a graduate of the University of Nairobi, Cambridge University, and New York University School of Law, where he was a Hauser Global Scholar. Magai has taught at the University of Nairobi, where he was a senior lecturer, and at NYU School of Law. Nikolai Rudinsky, who's on my immediate right, also a Reagan Fussell Fellow at NED, is the deputy editor of Grani.ru, an independent online media outlet. Trained as an ethnographer, he is the author of about 40 scholarly publications and more than 100 journalistic commentaries focusing mostly on public issues in today's Russia, including defending freedom of the press, exposing persecution of the regime's opponents, and other human rights violations, and combating racism and other forms of bigotry. On my immediate left, our third speaker will be Najib Sharifi, who is currently a Humphrey Fellow at the University of Maryland. Najib has been working for National Public Radio as a field producer in Afghanistan for 6 years. He's worked with the Washington Post, the New York Times, the BBC, the Wall Street Journal, and many other Western reporters. He has also worked as senior national political officer for the Office of the Special Representative of the European Union for Afghanistan. And then finally, and we're very, very pleased to have her back after all this time being away from us, back from the Balkan region, is Ivana Howard, Program Officer for Central and Eastern Europe here at the NED. Ivana just received a Master's in Democracy and Human Rights in Southeast Europe from the University of Sarajevo and University of Bologna. Her thesis, by the way, was on mistakes that donors make. It's a wonderful piece of scholarship. And if anyone is interested in seeing it, just let me know, and I have a copy of it. Ivana manages NED's Democracy Assistance Program in 6 Balkan countries. Her previous experiences include training U.S. soldiers, deploying to the Balkans in languages, politics, history, and culture of the region, as well as supporting the NATO peacekeeping mission in Bosnia and Herzegovina after the signing of the Dayton Peace Accords. Each of our speakers will be speaking for a period of 12 to 15 minutes, after which time we will open it up for discussion. So let me first begin by turning to Magai.
Thank you. I'd like to show you a short video clip, first of all, before I proceed. But let me place that in context. There are many dimensions to hate speech. And hate speech, and in many African countries, it tends to be or to revolve around questions of citizenship, contestations about citizenship in particular. And if you look at it in the broader context of human conflicts, what do people fight about? What do human beings fight about generally? It should be issues of dignity, issues of recognition, issues of respect as well. And these are things that are often missed in heated moments, especially when, in the Kenyan context, the world wakes up and you learn that 500 people were killed or something like that. The context matters a lot. And if you don't place things in context, then you can miss a lot, and you're not going to be able to help the situation. So I'd like to place this, first of all, within that context. And before getting to how we regulate hate speech, I also like to draw an analogy with defamation. In terms of, if you look at it in terms of a progression of how issues are discussed in the public, many times things progress from defamation to hate speech, and it happens across a long time. So the question then would be, why would we regulate hate speech and leave alone defamation? Because the defamation also matters in terms of dehumanizing people on a day-to-day basis, in terms of othering other communities, in the sense that the way it dominates people is to depict them as being different, to depict them as not being human. And often what we react to is their reaction rather than what generates that kind of hatred. We miss the history, we miss the context, we miss the politics. And that is what I'd like to show you with a clip from a game that I love. This is a game of soccer. You people call it football.
Now, Matarazzi did what? Just to kind of give us a bit more of a clue. He said something.
You can hear all this stuff.
Now what happens? He saying some more. Big trouble.
So who's the victim, really? Zidane, who was the captain of the French team, the guy that he headbutted was Marco Materazzi, a defender of the Italian team, and this was at the last World Cup in 2006. Now, who gets punished? Zidane, who probably caused the Zidane to react? Marco Materazzi. What happens? Do they? Does anybody say anything about what Marco Materazzi did? Often we blame the victims. We don't look at what is it that causes people to react in seemingly irrational manner, such as Zidane in that case, for instance. And so for me, soccer is a metaphor for what happens in real life on a day-to-day basis. Often the person who reacts is punished while the aggressor is not punished. Often the causes of conflicts are ignored and we tend to react to the manifestations of conflicts. According to a Kenyan journalist, for instance, we tend to see the headlines of events and not the background to events. So I'd like to, first of all, place hate speech within these context of contestations of citizenship before giving my views on how we should go about dealing with hate speech. And I think it's important, very important, that we're very careful how we frame the issues or the conflicts in the media, both in the international media and in the national media. And if you looked at what was happening in Kenya at the time, it was framed as a conflict between two tribes. So first of all, the conflict has been tribalized. The problem with that, and many of us from the continent complain about this on a day-to-day basis, is when you tribalize conflicts, you trivialize those conflicts. Because you're seemingly saying that there is some irrationality about these responses. There's some irrationality about the hate speech or the violence that may or may not result from it. But also you miss the context in which the hate speech and the violence takes place. And in the Kenyan context, for example, and I'll show this, much of the violence was occasioned by state security officers. I'll show you the figures. But the story that is told to the international press is that tribes were fighting, they killed one another. It's the usual African story of tribes fighting and killing one another. The usual story of irrational African tribes killing one another. But I think that misses the point. Because in many of these cases, it's about these contestations of citizenship. It's about these contestations of citizenship. It's about reactions to how people are treated on a day-to-day basis. So unless you resolve these conflicts, many of which have long historical roots, then you're never going to change to make the situation any better. We will always be failing to properly diagnose the problem. And that is what you see in the international media, for instance. Let me just show you one or two. This is a respected newspaper. This is the New York Times. And this is what the reporter, Jeffrey Gentleman, is saying about the poll. If you go to the third paragraph, it's saying it's war. Tribal war. Here's another one. Anyhow, I make the point. The other clip is of a headline. It says, post-election massacre in Kenya raises concerns of tribal war, which I think really misses the point of what was happening. And in that context, therefore, this hate speech is characterized as ethnic, as predatory. On the other hand, the idea is that people should somehow rise up and preach civility. So speech that is encouraged to be preaching national reconciliation This is the sort of speech that we want to label as constructive and civil. We want to discourage the predatory speech, the hate speech. But in doing that, I think we suppress debates about issues that really need to be resolved in the public domain. In framing conflicts in this manner, we fail to recognize and appreciate the history and the context of these conflicts. And so for me, many of these feuding communities are victims of institutionalized defamation, often perpetrated by mainstream media organizations, controlled by dominant ethnic groups in society. And as a result, many of these communities feel that they are being systematically dehumanized, they are being denied meaningful citizenship. So it seems to me that the international community should try harder to understand the context in which these conflicts take place. And in the Kenyan context, the conflict that was manifested in December of 2007 has deep, very deep historical roots. It has many complex dimensions. And unless we, I'll try to highlight some of these dimensions, unless we get to the bottom of these dimensions, of these conflicts, you can regulate, you can pass laws saying we will outlaw hate speech, but I don't think it's going to change anything. And in terms of resolving this thing, I think the fundamental question is this. How can we build sustainable democracies in multi-ethnic societies? And that is the context that should then inform the regulation of hate speech. And in that context, I'd like to see the media only as facilitators of collective action, in the sense that they are either proactive, seeking to dominate a political discourse, or they are reactive, in the sense of responding to dominant or the mainstream political agenda. Because of the internet, for instance, we like to say that each one of us is a reporter or a broadcaster. But I'd like to believe that whatever instrument you have, whether it is the phone that is going to send the SMS, nobody is going to buy into what you say unless it resonates with them. Nobody is going to pass it on to other people unless it makes sense to them. So you will not become, you may have the equipment, yes, but you will not become the broadcaster unless you have an audience. So I think what we really need to be addressing is, what is it that produces that audience? Why is it that there's a market for hate speech? And if you look at it that way, so and however hateful or distasteful these expressions may be, I think there's always something behind in terms of the real sentiment of the people that are expressing or making these statements. So if we miss that dominated dimension of the debate, then we will never be able to grapple with hate speech as such. So in the context of Kenya, for instance, you will hear stories of expressed differently, some in very graphic terms, statements such as, we want our land, we want our territory, you took our land, please give it back to us, we want to liberate ourselves. Okay. And also, an important dimension of this is that these conflicts also arise because state institutions themselves are often dominated by a few or by a particular ethnic community. State institutions are failed, or a combination of both of those phenomena. Again, Kenya provides a good example. At the time of the perpetration of the so-called hate speech, all the critical institutions were in the control of one ethnic community, before, during, and after the post-election violence. So even if you were to say, okay, let us do things according to the rule of law, are you going to get justice in these institutions? What is the best way of resolving contestations of citizenship, of dignity in a democratic society, if the established institutions themselves are dominated by particular groups and exclude others? And I'm talking about institutions that, such as the police, the public service, and the judiciary. Indeed, if you look at how the Kenyan conflict has been characterized, the roles of these actors tend to be ignored. To give you an example in terms of the role that the police or security actors played in the post-election violence, both before and before, during, and after. The story we are told when you read the New York Times, for instance, or The Economist, or which is the other? The BBC, I think, they get it these days. But if you generally look at the representations of the conflict, the story you hear is that tribal war caused 1,000 people to die. But when you analyze who killed whom, then you realize that that is not the entire story. For instance, gunshot wounds resulted in the deaths of 405 people. Who have guns? Who have the guns? It's the police. By the time that much of this was happening, the government had banned live coverage of events, whether by radio or television. So we really can't know exactly what the police will do. This is from, this is a report of the Commission of Inquiry into the post-election violence. So that is exactly what it is telling us. So again, unless we place hate speech in context, we're going to be missing quite a lot in terms of what is happening within some of these communities. And also, I think it's important to look at the context in which the media itself operates. And in this regard, I'd just like to pose a few questions. Who dominates political discourse in society, and why? Who owns the media? Is there diversity? Who controls editorial policy? Even if the media has been liberalized, is there journalistic freedom? In many of these contexts, hate speech tends to be reactionary. It is a response to exclusion from the dominant political discourse. And Kenya, again, is a good illustration. And if you look at the media, for instance, in the mainstream media in Kenya, talking about the major radio and newspaper and TV stations, they are often aligned with dominant political interests. The media owners control editorial policies. Journalists complain that they lack journalistic freedom. Another interesting example is that as this was happening, the post-election violence was happening, we learned that the mainstream media stations, such as the Daily Nation, the Citizen TV, and the Kenya Television Network, they had all put up electoral databases to help with the counting of the votes. What happened? All of these databases crashed. Do we want to believe that that was an accident? So how then do we deal with or regulate hate speech in this sort of context? And I'd like to draw a distinction between defamation and hate speech. And my point basically is that really it's going to be very difficult to tell the difference between the two. See how they tend to define hate speech. It is speech which offends, threatens, or insults groups based on race, color, religion, national origin, gender, sexual orientation, disability, or a number of other traits. And how do they define defamation? The communication of a statement that makes a claim expressly stated or implied to be factual that may give an individual, business, product, group, government, or nation a negative image. So I'll give you examples of the sort of conversation that you'll be hearing. Or community X is lazy. They don't work. They are hooligans. John Doe cannot become president because he's from community X, because they are lazy, because they don't work, etc. Okay? And this is something that you see in the mainstream media on a regular basis. And because it appears in the mainstream media, it tends to acquire some form of legitimacy. And therefore, it acquires some form of legitimacy. So this is something that people live with on a day-to-day basis in many such contexts. I'm running out of time. So I think we cannot really choose to simply regulate hate speech and leave and fail to deal with the sort of information that goes on a day-to-day basis, and that in many cases is what produces the hate speech in the first place. But even if we were to say, let us just regulate hate speech, how would we define hate? Who decides what amounts to hate and what doesn't? How inclusive or impartial are the institutions of criminal justice which are supposed to make these determinations? And in a context in which the institutions of government are not inclusive, how can there be fairness in this sort of determinations? So I'd like to suggest that the state cannot regulate hate speech effectively if it is perceived by the citizens to be illegitimate, or if state institutions are themselves perceived to be illegitimate. And it also seems to me that the dominant approaches to hate speech emphasize punishment of offenders. They emphasize the use of the criminal law. I doubt the wisdom of that myself, in the sense that the emphasis seems to be on punishment rather than integration, rather than dealing with the causes of these forms of expression. In my view, perhaps better results will result from looking at the history, the context that produces the hate speech, and seeking to figure out how do we create meaningful citizenship. And again, in the context of text messages, for instance, who should be punished, the person who originates the hate speech or the person who passes it on? In the context of local registration, I'm finishing. A common response is to close them, to say, let us just shut off these stations. But I think that often plays into the hands of governments that are dominated by the dominant communities, in the sense that it then takes away the voice of minorities. And in such context, I think it's very difficult to balance the need to regulate hate speech with the need for freedom of speech. So I think this is an instrument that ought to be used very, very carefully, if at all. So in conclusion, what does all of this mean in terms of building democracies in multi-ethnic societies or divided societies? I think building inclusive democracies is perhaps the best response to hate speech in terms of inclusive citizenship, diversity, equitable distribution of resources and opportunities. And in Kenya's context, happily, these ideals have been included in our proposed new constitution. And what then is required is for local and international actors to work to ensure the realization of these ideals. Secondly, these societies need sources of independent analysis which can contribute to balancing viewpoints in political discourse. And last but not least, I think there's a need for research in two areas. One, how the liberalized media impacts on democracy in multi-ethnic societies, and two, the socio-political context in which the media in such societies operates. And I think such research can enhance the quality of the contribution that organizations such as CIMA make to establishing sustainable democracies in divided societies. Thank you very much. I apologize for taking too much time.
Thank you very much, Miguel. You've made the issue one of complexity, and you've introduced a number of themes that I hope we can return to when we get to our discussion. Let me turn to Nikolai.
Thank you, David. Well, let me start by saying that we in Russia have a very special attitude towards America. No, it's ambivalent. On the one hand, there is a lot of anti-Americanism throughout the society. On the other hand, America is respected. Well, anyway, America is the only country to which we like to be compared, to which we would accept to be compared. And the issue of hate speech is a really good one for this comparison, or rather contrast, because here is what might be termed as Russian-American hate speech paradox, if I may call it this way. So with some simplification, it can be said that in America there is no legal ban on hate speech. Well, perhaps some very specific situations should be exceptions, but basically it is covered by the First Amendment, like David said. And yet, hate speech seems to be, by and large, effectively controlled by the society, by the civil society. There are some checks on hate speech, which, again, by and large, with some exception, work so that hate speech is largely marginalized. While in Russia, with all these legal prohibitions on which I'm going to talk further on, there is lots of hate speech, which is which goes mostly unchecked, and it can be said that in many cases hate speech against minorities is not marginal fringe, it's a lunatic fringe, it's a part of mainstream, and also I'll talk on this later. And now about this legal situation, like I said, we have an article in a criminal code that is right about hate speech. Well, but more precisely, it's about incitement of hatred or hostility, as well as humiliation on grounds of ethnicity, religion, and so on and so forth. And, well, perhaps I would quote, I try to be in brief, actions directed at incitement of hatred or hostility, as well as at humiliation of a human being or a group according to gender, race, national origin, language, at religion, as well as, mind you, belonging to any social group. So these such actions are punishable by fine or with some aggravating circumstances. It can be a prison term up to 5 years. For Americans, this may seem rather weird, and indeed it is, especially when you see this addition, quite a recent one, of social groups to ethnicity, religion, race, and so on, which is quite unusual. I still fail to understand why it was added, but it was, And some interesting cases have already taken place since. A certain blogger in a Russian province was, in fact, indicted for writing something really nasty in his blog about corrupt policemen. And indeed, technically, the indictment was correct, because who says who can say that corrupt policemen are not a social group? Of course they are. Yeah. But well, fortunately, the case was dismissed later on, but still this social thing is something that puzzles me a lot, and I'm afraid will continue to puzzle many people. But just to finish with that one, of course, when that man was indicted, the word corrupt policeman was conveniently deleted from the corrupt, I mean, was deleted from the indictment. It was just policeman, but well, perhaps it was not so unnatural, because, well, many in Russia believe that a non-corrupt policeman is a contradiction in terms. So perhaps they had a reason to do so. Now, with this particular article in the criminal code, well, perhaps if we make this comparison of which I was talking about, perhaps in this respect it's not an indicator of Russia's backwardness in comparison with America, well, as some Russia's peculiarities are. Because, like David said again, many modern democracies have such laws on the books about incitement of hatred on religious, ethnic, racial, and other grounds. And moreover, there is international legal provision to that effect. May I remind you, ladies and gentlemen, about Article 20 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which was adopted in 1966, and characteristically it was, as it was ratified by the United States, which happened quite late in 1991, the United States made a special reservation that they are not accepting this particular provision. Now, paragraph 2 of that article reads like this: any advocacy of national, racial, or religious hatred that constitutes incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence shall be prohibited by law. So, by having a law like this, Russia is in compliance with international law, which is basically a good thing. But, of course, it's not so important what laws we have on the books. It's important how laws are being implemented. And here comes the main problem. And my main point is that perhaps Russia's example is, well, the best way to demonstrate that either such legal ban on hate speech should not exist, or it should only exist in a society with a rule of law, independent judiciary, and all rather, well, you know, paraphernalia of a civilized state, which unfortunately Russia is not. So, generally speaking, this legal provision has been implemented very selectively, very unfairly, and more often than not with a political bias. And it's not so much against to protect minorities as to protect the government. And well, to bring some just a few examples. For example, one of the people who are actually doing their prison terms on this particular article is a man, a journalist, whose name is Boris Tumakhin, who really published something very well, offensive about Russia as a nation and Russians as a people. Again, I am not at all in agreement with what he wrote about the Russians as a people, but still, well, he didn't do anything. He was just, you know, writing and publishing, and he got a five-year jail term. He got a term of 5 years, and I think the court never didn't care, or perhaps did care, about the fact that the man did not attack any minorities, which he was writing, again, nasty things maybe, against clearly the dominant group, the majority, which is not vulnerable. So there was not real danger that his, statements as offensive as they maybe could bring any harm. Well, anyway, that's one case. Then, of course, it should be also mentioned that this particular crime, incitement of racial, religious, social hatred and so on, is now covered by a very dubious legal concept of extremism, which is often used just to, to circumscribe, to limit free speech. And there are many examples of how people are persecuted under this legal provision, but, enough is to say that when a human rights advocacy group in a city of Novorossiysk came out with the slogan, "Freedom is not given, freedom is taken." It was found extremist. And at the same time, there was a criminal case in Petersburg when a group of, skinheads, you may say, attacked and beat severely a boy from Armenia, shouting, among other things. Well, I even know I feel uneasy how to beat or kill. Maybe the rough equivalent would be the N-word, you know, a very, very derogatory nickname for Armenians. And, it was a legal opinion, an expert opinion was requested whether these the defendants should be also tried under this article of incitement to racial and religious hatred. And an expert, psycholinguist, this is normally people to whom they go for legal opinion on these matters, she gave an opinion saying that probably not, because this phrase could have been pronounced in a way of joke. So, you see, it's, again, I think, by the way, it's very regrettable that courts, that the judges, do not rely on their own judgment in such matters. They use these experts who, and these are, more often than not, I'm maybe if I say something wrong about them, I may be indicted under the same article, because they are social group, these experts. But their opinions are sometimes really, weed. I will use a very mild term for this. And at the same time, many instances of hate speech against minorities not just go unpunished, but there is not even talk of legal action being taken. For instance, 3 or 4 years ago, there was a so-called letter of 500 signed by a dozen or so members of the parliament, the State Duma, and many, you know, authors and cultural figures, figures of different, level of prominence, mostly belonging to what my Russian nationalist trend, it was 500 signatures were there, and it was an appeal to close down all Jewish organizations in Russia on the grounds of Judaism being an anti-human religion, discriminatory and nasty by definition. And well, of course, it wasn't, no action was taken upon. Fortunately, this appeal was not followed by the authorities, but its authors were not dealt with in any way, although it was a clear-cut case of violating this particular article of the criminal code. It was an appeal to discrimination on ethnic and religious grounds. And just a more recent case, perhaps it should be publicized, it happened in this past summer when the mayor of Sochi, Mr. Anatoly Pakomov, and as you may know, Sochi will host the Winter Olympics in the year 2014. So he said publicly, among other things, commenting on the work on those Olympic objects and the influx of migrants that should be limited somehow, he focused on the gypsies. Well, nobody uses the word Roma in Russia. It's nobody is politically correct enough. So the gypsies, he said, should be brought in and forcibly made to work at Olympic construction sites, like they did in Soviet time when there was a real war like this against vagrancy and something like that. So it was said by a mayor of the capital of the Olympics, and well, no one cared. So there was a response, of course, in the media. Some came out with a criticism of such an outrageous statement, but the biggest national newspaper published, well, an article by a very famous, very influential columnist who commented on this like that. Well, yes, this perhaps Mr. Pakomov, that mayor, was a bit reckless coming out with this recommendation, because, you know, the gypsies are there such people. There are many material values on those construction sites. So perhaps he should be wary from bringing them in, otherwise those values would disappear. And again, yeah, as I already mentioned, you know, humiliation of ethnic groups on basis of ethnicity is also a crime in Russia. Again, no one cared. So, well, there is also religion, but just one word about it. You know, some people who organized art exhibitions with some exhibits could be found offensive by mainly the Russian Orthodox Christians. They were indicted and tried under the same article for incited religious hatred, which they did not. Perhaps they could have been tried for blasphemy, but blasphemy is not a crime in Russian law. So I'm finishing. This legal provision has been used in a most arbitrary and ineffective way. So if we are to answer this question, whether there should be a legal ban on hate speech, then Russia should be example against such a ban. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Nikolai. You know you're safe here, but we are recording. I just want you to know.
On the website.
Now I'll turn to Najib to talk about Afghanistan.
I'm going to go to the podium so that everybody can see me.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be with you today. I'm going to start to run you through the history of media in Afghanistan very briefly, because that will give you a better picture of how the situation built up and how it led to the situation that we have there today. Actually, The media history goes to the beginning of the 20th century in Afghanistan. The very first paper that was established in Afghanistan was in 1905, although it was a state-run newspaper. Shortly after its establishment, it started to criticize the government for its incorrect actions. A good example of it was the government's disproportionate proximity to the British. And with limited freedom, the media started to evolve until 1964, when we approved the new constitution, which gave a lot of freedom to media and guaranteed freedom of expression in Afghanistan. But actually, that decade, the 1960s, the decade of democracy, we had lots of papers, although not all, most of them private, were established in the country, and they were mainly for the purpose of acting as a watchdog on the government and on the society. So I'm pointing out to these examples to outline the fact that today's situation is a product of war. Well, later on in the achievements, we lost all the achievements in 1979 when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, and we obviously had a pro-Soviet communist regime, communist autocratic regime that was established in Afghanistan. And those days we only had one national state-run TV and a couple of local state-run or local government-run TV stations and a couple of radio stations in the country and some papers that were all state-run or government-controlled. And their main job was to propagate propaganda against Mujahideen who had risen up to fight against the Soviet and to destroy the West and capitalism in those days. And later on, it was being used for the purpose of indoctrination. So people did not have those days, you know, the way that that it was going those days. So the idea that the new generation was getting from the media was merely a tool that's being used for the purpose of propaganda. That's it. This continued until 1992, when the Soviet, the pro-Soviet regimes collapsed and Mujahideen took over, and we had more limitations. Actually, the number of media, state-run media that we had decreased because of the war, and later on during the Taliban, the situation became even worse because according to the interpretation of the Taliban, TV was not allowed because it was considered un-Islamic, and we had a couple of state-run radios that was still being used for the purpose of propaganda for the Taliban and to destroy the enemies of the Taliban, which was the Northern Alliance at the time. And the papers that we had those days, we had pictures in the papers, but the papers were not allowed to print any living creatures, the pictures of any living creatures those days. After Taliban fall in 2001, with the establishment of the new administration in Afghanistan, we had a sudden dramatic boom in the industry of the media. And this was basically because of the thirst that people developed for freedom of media and freedom of expression. Because of the 20 years of autocratic regimes that we had in Afghanistan, which did not allow the freedom of speech and freedom of media. And suddenly we had dozens of papers establishing in the country and later on TV stations and radio stations. As today we have got more than 40 private TV stations in Afghanistan, more than 100 private radio stations and several hundreds of papers in Afghanistan. This itself was a huge achievement in the country, but it was met with problems in the sense that we did not have enough professionals in the country to fill in the industry, and because of the fact that the warlords who were feeling that they were losing their power in the country, they were searching for ways to maintain their power and influence over the government and over the society. And they realized that owning media outlets would be a very good tool to maintain their influence and their power over the government and the society. It was quite astonishing to people that to see that the very first TV station that was, the very first private TV station that was established in Afghanistan was established by a notorious warlord named General Dostum. And the same, other papers and later on other TV stations and radio stations were established by other warlords to preserve their power. And at the same time, we had independent independent news organization or media outlets that were coming out. But as I said earlier, we had the problem of lack of professionalism in the country. So today, the media outlets that's controlled by the warlords in the country, they are mainly doing their reportage and their work based on defending and protecting their own political, their own factional, their own ethnic agenda and to propagate their ideology. There's no sense and taste of working as real news organizations or as real media outlets. And at the same time, the independent news organizations that we have there, because of lack of having professionals there, they do not understand how to work to maintain the independence and impartiality of them as journalists. So this, for a society like Afghanistan, it is to have such kind of a media is very dangerous, because this is a country that has newly started to practice democracy, and we know that the media is a very crucial element to achieve democracy in the country, and we are losing the value of media, or we are losing a very strong and important tool to achieve the media. And secondly, it is professional practicing of media in Afghanistan is very crucial, because people need to have need to build an idea of how journalism should be and how journalists should work, and we need to win the trust of the people for the media. Once again, particularly for a country which is already divided, and practicing of journalism in this way deepens the divide that already exists in the country. This type of this work has already, we see that it's already stopped, deepened the divide between the ethnic groups, between the linguistic groups, and between the political parties and the factions. And this comes at a very crucial time, because in order to be able to achieve nation building and state building, we need unity and we need solidarity, and anything that can damage the unity and solidarity of the nation at this point can be very devastating for the country. And in a country like Afghanistan, to outlaw defamation or the hatred of speech cannot work, in the sense, because mostly laws remain on the paper. And for example, already we have in the constitution that the media should operate within the domain of being respectful and not doing anything that can hurt the unity of the nation and the country. And secondly, hatred and defamation is an issue that cannot have, or it's hard to have a clear-cut definition for such an for the concept of defamation and a hatred of speech. And thirdly, if we outlaw this, this will give a very good reason and excuse for the government to impose more restrictions on the media and on the journalists, as because we still have, it's a country that's newly started to achieve democracy, but it's still in the minds of people who run the government, particularly the security agents, we still have, they still harbor those dictator and autocratic ideas, which means that they will start to crack down on reporters, and we will be lose one of the big achievements that we have had in the country, which is a huge boom in the industry of media. So the best way, in my idea, to solve the problem is to professionalize reporters in the country, so that they could get a sense of what their mission and mandate as reporters are, to how to do their job and what they can do that can minimize harm and that can do good for the country. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. And let me turn now to Ivana Howard to talk about the Balkans.
I think I'll also go up there because my jet lag is getting better.
When David was introducing me, he mentioned that I'm a program officer, and you can see it in the agenda. I'm a program officer here at the National Endowment, and I manage programs in six Balkan countries. And when we as program officers and other program staff here talk on various subjects, whether it be hate speech or political developments, we usually like to approach the topic through the eyes of our grantees and through the work that our grantees do, rather than speaking maybe in our own capacity. So I will take a slightly different approach and maybe focus on the work that our grantees are doing in the region. Focus is going to be, like the introduction has said, primarily on Serbia and Bosnia, and I'll explain why as I go along. But basically, there are two aspects. I was thinking about how to approach this best, and there are two aspects that you really have to consider when you talk about hate speech, its consequences in the region and the way to regulate it. One I'm going to mention, because simply it is impossible not to mention it when you talk about the Balkans, and that is the role of media, that the media has played in the wars of the 1990s. But we could spend really a vast amount of time speaking about this, and I'm just going to mention it because it provides really a good context for what is going on right now. As you already know, the Balkan region has gone through bloody wars in the 1990s, and the media has really played an enormous role in setting the stage for these conflicts and for basically creating conditions for these conflicts to occur and for the hatred to really have some of the bloodiest results in the modern world, or basically after World War II. What is really disappointing is that today, in 2009, no serious sanctions have been taken against media outlets that have perpetrated some of these war propaganda and incited hate speech. Probably the most prominent case that is going on right now is the case of Vojislav Šešelj, the leader of the Serbian Radical Party, who is indicted and is currently facing trial, trial is undergoing, if you can even call it that, because he's been successfully stalling it since it started in November of 2007. And I believe in his indictment, the counts 10 and 11 deal with the use of inflammatory speech for inciting hatred and violence against the Croatian minority in the northern province of Vojvodina in Serbia. Basically, what happened is in May of 1992, Vojislav Šešelj had come with his supporters to this village of Hrtkovci, which had an ethnic Croatian minority, and had basically incited or created an atmosphere of fear And he had even called out 17 names of ethnic Croats living in the village, calling upon them to leave the village if they were to going to be safe and basically not be killed almost. And that the reason he cited for it was that if the Croat families move out, then the Serb refugee families from Croatia and later from Bosnia could move into their houses. Now, we're still anxiously waiting to see how this count pans out and whether the Hague Tribunal is going to be able to really prove this case, because it may have serious implications for what happens in Serbia's media scene. Because like I mentioned at the beginning, no one to this day has faced serious consequences for inciting, basically through using war propaganda. And in lieu of this institutional mechanism or legal mechanism to address some of these hate speech used for war propaganda purposes, what some of our grantees are doing, basically, is, and this is probably the best they can do